You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie, and joining me now, Marty Gibson, master of the airwaves from the Papadopoulos. You had a busy week on Friday last week, Marty. Marty.
Yeah, how are you doing, Marie?
I'm good.
Yeah, no, it was pretty bit of overexposure. Got a bit overexposed. I always make that joke that the difference between RCR hosts and our mainstream media lovies is that RCR hosts are more famous than they want to be.
Well, I enjoyed having Double Marty. Absolutely, particularly enjoyed your Fourth Estate chat with Peter and
Rachel. That was a good one. I enjoyed that too a lot. Yeah. Always enjoy Peter Williams' very laconic take on things. And, of course, Rachel as well. You've spoken to her quite a few times. It was the first time I'd spoken to her in any way. And, yeah, what a joy
she is. She's a trick. Yeah, she's an absolute trick.
I hope to go and shoot something with her at some point.
Yeah, no, I thoroughly enjoyed that. And, of course, if you missed it, it is up on the replays page on the app. So do go and check that out. It's been a funny old weekend and few days in the papers. It's pretty much divided into two halves, what's going on here domestically and what's going on internationally, and we're going to have a look at both. We thought we would start at home first before we went abroad. Last week I said, with everything going on, it was the case of bread and circuses, but the bread was stale and the circus was shit. Nothing's changed this week, and in fact I feel almost an amplification from last week on that theme. The first major thing, of course, is that there have been the rounds of party conferences, starting with politics, party conferences. The Greens had theirs. Now National has been in the turn of having their conference. From all accounts, they rolled out Farmer John. Yeah. I wonder how Christopher Luxon feels not being the most fawned over person in the room.
Ricky Gervais said of his character, David Brent, in The Office, you know, the thing with him is he just wants to be loved. So if you look at him in that sense, you can feel quite tender towards him, because all of this goofy stuff he's doing, like, you know, when that lady chops the top off a coconut and then he gets splashed with water and then he posts it on his whatever and says, why do I consent to do this sort of stuff? You know, he's just trying to be liked, but the more he does that, the more people get irritated by him. And it actually suits him better just to be business as usual. And I was thinking this morning, it would actually work for him quite well if he just acknowledged it. He said, look, I know I'm not popular. I'm not, you know, his greatest transgression to New Zealand's female journalists is he doesn't give them the tingles.
No, he gives them the ick.
Yeah. You don't get away with that. If he just acknowledged that and just said, look, here's what I'm here to do. And, you know, even better if he, you know, said, look, we're trying to get as many capable New Zealanders into leadership positions as possible and set them up with a good culture of managing things, people would buy that too. But there's that whole, you know, once people get to know Chris Luxon, they'll really like him. And you always hear, you know, in person, he's quite an engaging, likable guy.
Economically, it looks like the dung is about to hit the fan. I wonder whether there's a dawning realisation by those in the electorate and the media that actually, unlike the predecessors, that their solution was to throw money, that printed money or borrowed money, at a problem and hope that it would go away. Whereas that is now no longer an option. The debt balloon is even bigger and will continue to get bigger based on the budgeted numbers from Nicola Willis. That actually the government is not going to be there to wipe your nose and clean your bottom, and that actually Kiwis are going to have to fix a lot of this themselves.
Yeah. This is another theme that our regular listeners would be familiar with. Another difference between mainstream media and Reality Check Radio is that we're willing to countenance the idea that disaster may be heading toward New Zealand from multiple different directions, not the only allowable direction that they're allowed to talk about, which is climate as a result of anthropogenic CO2. the signs are all there to put together. There's no conspiracy theory needed. The US share market is just absolutely tanked. Over $1.93 trillion wiped off the US stock market. The NASDAQ down 1,000 points, the most it's ever fallen. I think it was on
Black Monday, they're calling it, because the Japanese, well, it's been a cascade. The Japanese went as well on the back of the poor job numbers forecast out of the US, and they tumbled by 12.4%. I think the Koreans were 9.1%. They're all just going,
Yeah, and meanwhile, we've got the Reserve Bank saying they're aiming to have a digital currency in place by 2030. This is after saying, we're getting submissions and we just want to find out, want to find out what people want. But it turns out that, it doesn't really matter so much. Mm. We're going to have a digital currency like all central banks around the world are putting in place. And it's probably going to be linked to some creepy social credit system that's going to control what we consume and what we do and monitor it all. And it's going to be driven by AI. So, there's quite a few things that we're quite happy to talk about because they're there on RCR. But if you've got a newspaper with the first three or four pages of it, Harvey Norman ads advertising 36 months interest-free, you don't really want to have content inside that says that the financial system seems about to collapse, that the banks are about to introduce digital currencies, that confines your use of money to the things the psychos in the World Economic Forum approve of when they're telling us that we'll own nothing and be happy.
Well, what was this thing I sent you in terms of the debt? Like, we've often talked about what the $196 billion of debt, crown debt, right? Well, inflation. 215 now, 215 crown debt. New Zealanders, we are a nation in debt in the housing sector. $361 billion, local government $27 billion, agriculture $63 billion, student loans $12 billion, business $136 billion, and consumer debt at $15
billion. Yeah, it's not a bug, it's a feature. There are people who have inveigled themselves the right to print money, and for a couple of centuries, practically, they've been finding all sorts of ingenious ways to turn their fake toilet paper money into real land. Mm. And now they own most of it. By 2030, those big private equity firms are going to own 60% of the US residential market.
Yeah. Did you see the massive drop off in Bitcoin value?
Yeah.
Sell down. And hello, guess who's been buying a lot of Bitcoin?
Who?
BlackRock.
Right. Those cryptocurrencies are a major roadblock to central banks making their own cryptocurrencies. They don't want competition in that area. And so they want to get rid of it. There was a segment I saw, I think Alex Jones did it, about the likelihood of a cyber attack prior to the US election. And that the one we experienced last month was basically a little system test for that. So, there's all sorts of clouds gathering on the horizon, and I don't want to make people gloomy. We just talking about it and understanding it, hopefully will give our leaders a bit of spine to at least start talking about it, because once we start talking about it, we're more likely to arrive at a solution.
And a lot of it, I think, comes back. So here in New Zealand, when you've got so much that's outside of your control, it's out there in the ether that we can't control, you then ask yourself, well, what can we control? Mm. And that's where your zipper consensus comes back in. And that's, how do we control things the best we can in our families? How do we then we ripple that out to the, extended families, the community, the street that we live on, wider community that we're in, which is why the centralization of a lot of local government, not Smanati, because I think more of it needs to be back in the seats of where people live and feel that they have more control. And you look at what's sort of been brewing around in politics and what's been happening, and Bruce Cottrell actually dedicated an entire story to the Greens this week. Mm. And And the nub of his story was around how the Greens had completely lost their way of who it is that they were. They'd lost their identity. They'd stopped reflecting what it said on the outside of the tin. So instead of being a Green Party, they are essentially a socialist party. I think he sums it up beautifully here as one of the reasons we do better than most is that those earnest Green Party politics from the 1990s, although they seemed a bit wacky at the time, gave us an environmental conscience. And although it took time, we slowly changed our habits. I often wonder what Donald and Fitzsimmons might have achieved if they had the social media channels available today. However, the current Green Party show no signs of using these social media channels to lead another generation to a better environmental place. They don't talk about the oceans or the bush. They talk about Palestinians, Indigenous rights and rainbows communities. And it's about that losing that sense of self. And I think we, as Kiwis, have lost our sense of self and wanting to concentrate on those things closer to home that are important to us.
Having covered a lot of the stuff in my time as a journalist, I observed that there's a big difference between environmentalists and conservationists. Conservationists, you know, if you want to talk to them, you got to say, can I just talk to you for a sec? And they sort of pause and lean on their shovel out of breath. Environmentalists get together from having their cups of tea and talking about things, say, oh, we're going to have a photo, well, let's plant a tree.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of this work in conservation. I've planted tens of thousands of trees. I've lived in the bush for a month and cut about 10 kilometres of tracks to trap possums and then trapped possums. And it's hard work. And I understand that need for conservation at a very practical level. And so, yeah, I do see the fluttering around of, what is it? What do you call it? What's her, in the world of Aotearoa or Kiwi Farm, is it Chloe Pony?
Oh, Joey Salbrick.
Yeah. No, I don't relate to them particularly in terms of what needs to be done. In fact, it's they're almost in the way. That they're putting people off what should be an urgent mission by all of us to improve the state of our freshwater. And you can do it because, oh, it's just so bad and mean to have dirty water. You could say, hey, let's get stuck in, it'll improve the fishing. Generally, the more life that teems around New Zealand's coastline, the better for all of us. And then we can, you know, stop, you know, having certain people based on race claim the right to do things, which divides us further. And
Cottrell's just spent some time in the US, and he said, you don't actually realise how much as a nation that we've sort of done that from a conservation standpoint is a good thing. Like, I mean, the plastic bags, that was one policy that came out during those 6 dark years that I was like, I mean.
Well, I wasn't, because I used to work in the plastics industry, and it's a red herring, because paper's so much worse for the environment than plastic. And the thing about plastic is you can recycle it more easily than paper. You know, an Official Information Act request that I regret not making was to ask, on all of your trips overseas, Miss Ardern, did you ever ask any of the leaders of the top 5 or 10 nations for dumping plastic straight into rivers to stop? And if not, where does that leave me walking home with the ass falling out of my paper bag and look at my plastic-wrapped food rolling around on the pavement? If you didn't make a move to say, hey, look, if you're backing trucks up to rivers that are going out into the ocean and dumping rubbish in them, maybe you could stop that, because New Zealand probably wouldn't release even one load of plastic bags into the ocean each year.
One of the things that I've often said to people when it comes to anything that we do down here, like on scale, lack thereof, is whether, you know, the whole emissions thing, right? I mean, we're a flea fart in a hurricane. We meaningless. And I don't think people want to be told that anything that they do is meaningless. So then why do it? Well, for many of the Greens, you do it for virtue, don't you? So the meaning is in the virtue, not in the action.
Yeah, turning up to a protest. And all these kids have been really, really trained to protest as a route to meaning. And it's very, very empty.
I don't know whether you caught it, because it was actually, I think, in the Canvas section of the Saturday Herald. There was an article called Waking Up to Wokedom. The heading is Waking Up to Wokedom, Highly Principled or Out of Touch with Reality. Joanna Wayne discovers even liberal parents think Generation Woke has gone too far. I thought the headline was a bit off. It should have been, what happens when your children become even more woke and insufferable than you? Is what the headline should have been. But I digress. And I'm going to read out three or so parents that they interviewed. Firstly, lofty social values are all very well. She was told by her exasperated mother, Victoria, but you still need a job to pay the rent. It's this idea that you don't want to be part of the rat race, but you still want the privilege of a rat, says Victoria, a feminist Green Party supporter with socialist centre-left views. It then goes on and says, but Victoria isn't the only one of her liberal friends who thinks the pendulum has swung too far, making young people overly sensitive to other points of view and out of touch with reality. Let's fast forward across to, it's the polarity of views and lack of nuanced discussion that bothers Anne. Anne is an Auckland-based manager for a social development organisation and mother of three, who describes herself as so far left, she has trouble walking straight. My girls have incredibly strong views about Palestine, but if I ask them some hard-searching questions, I'm not sure they could answer in a meaningful way.
Like, where is it on a map?
Mm-hmm. And then let's go down to Daniel. Daniel is a Gen Xer, like you and I, who works in the creative industries and is definitely in the woke camp, in quotation marks. But the performative nature of social media posts and the latest hot takes irritate him too. There's this frantic need to be seen to support the right cause and choose a side quickly, he says. As you get older, you realise it's a lot more complex. I feel like there's a lot of talking and not enough listening. But it's a desperate time for young people growing up in the world right now. And when you think back to the youth quake of the 60s and 70s, you kind of want that, right? It helps engage society and makes older generations question their values. Finally, when Aucklander Izzy Fenwick commissioned some research here, almost half the people who were interviewed aged between 20 and 40, all in full-time corporate jobs, said they'd turned down a role or employment offer because it didn't align with their ethics. 3 months ago, Fenwick launched Futureful, a recruitment platform that helps to identify organisations that are compatible with their values, especially for Gen Zers and millennials. What's really challenging is they're completely disempowered to do anything about it. They can't actually reject a capitalist society or fossil fuels because they don't have the systemic social license or power to do that. I think there's a frustration towards older generations where, yes, there are some major complexities there, but that's also seen as a total cop-out, not wanting to sacrifice money and power wrapped up in the status quo. There's so much that they can do other than signal how strongly they feel. If you look at woke's origin meanings as a political slang for alertness to racial prejudice and discrimination, how can that be a bad thing? Now, I've just taken some excerpts out of that. I think it is available online. The thing that stunned me, so I read that alongside everything else. Everything else that I have read this week. And I'm thinking, oh, the luxury and the privilege that you're actually able to select and turn down a job because it doesn't align with your values. And Steve Mahari was banging on again about good jobs. Remember him? He was banging on about that a few months ago. What is a good job, Steve? What is a good job? Punishment doesn't conjure up a job, is the headline.
Yeah, I had a lot of pink highlighter on that. Yeah, he's basically saying, yeah, we should make people work, but we should pay the people who are administering the dole properly. If the government is prepared to shoulder its responsibilities, holding people responsible for seeking a job becomes realistic. If they choose not to look for work, sanctions are a reasonable response. But he's saying, yeah, work and income should be funded so it can offer support for job seekers. Policies aimed at ensuring there are good jobs to seek should be implemented, especially in those areas of the country, such as Northland, that are economically depressed. It's a bit like the Greens never having planted trees on a 45-degree angle or carried possum traps over 10K of bush. I wonder whether a lot of these people who are all for workers or the unemployed have ever had to do a ball bag job. My thought with it often is that just like you get unfit and you don't want to have someone who's a gym bunny get you started because they've forgotten what it's like to start. I think the same with work, you know. I think if someone's been sitting around pulling bongs and playing PlayStation for a few years, an eight-hour day doing a mindless job is so tough. And, I mean, I've done jobs like that. I mean, Chris Rock did a hilarious bit about this recently. If you look at your watch and you think it's been an hour but it's been 5 minutes, you're in a job. If you look at your watch and think, oh, where's all the time gone? You're in a career.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, Mahari even goes on and says, even when there's a job, it all too often doesn't pay a living wage, is insecure and offers no future prospects. The mantra that any job is better than no job is something said by people who all have good jobs. A bad job leads to poverty, food banks, and a raft of problems. There is a better way. While holding job seekers to account, the government might like to do the same to itself.
Yeah. Now, he doesn't mean it in the way we'd mean that, though, does he?
No, and I can't.
You mean spend more money, government?
Yeah, I have to admit, I look at that. And of course, you know, we both have school-aged children, so you worry about this stuff. You worry about what is there going to be for these kids when they come out the other side. And I've just finished chatting with Lee Taitua. And we were talking about that, you know, what is available for these kids? What is one of the things I said to him is I asked him the question that all the treaty settlements, one of the unexpected consequences of that was all of a sudden a lot of these kids that came out of the iwi got access to education at university or tertiary education, but it's that education that's indoctrinated them that's now created this elite issue. So therefore, has it been those real jobs that would normally be fulfilling for a community and for a family? They're not wanting to do that now. That doesn't.
Well, they should have made a rule that for every Maori lawyer that graduated, you needed to see two engineers and two doctors. I think that would have been a good rule.
Yeah. You know, what is a job? And I worry that the jobs are just simply not going to be there, and that picking and choosing is not something that luxury people can afford anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I don't by any means take, you know, what would be regarded as a pure right-wing view on this. I think, you know, there are a series of decisions taken to open up trade, and it necessarily was going to make some people really rich. And, you know, the days of a man being able to go out to work digging ditches or whatever, come home to a wife who'd been able to stay at home raising the kids, and maybe even go to the pub four times a week and get drunk, you know, those days are gone. Working people have been ground down, and, you know, that's the thing, that it's amazing that there wasn't a peep out of Labor when all of those billionaires increased their wealth by 25-50%. You know, that came from the government subsidies that ultimately now is paid back by working people through tax.
And it's that whole sort of some negative game in the taxes. Like, I really do believe in the working poor, in the sense that you've got just frickin' hundreds of thousands of Kiwis out there who are working their tripes out, either multiple jobs or long hours, to get food on the table and get their kids educated into sport and all the things that, you know, have a Kiwi dream, whether they be born here or not. And they're now sort of paying some tax in one hand, only to have it returned back to them in the form of a family credit. So it's sort of a zero-sum game, isn't it?
You can normally follow the trail of breadcrumbs back to the people who are allowed to print the money. You know, they've sort of flooded liquidity into the country. And we've all outbidded each other on the same dubious housing stock. And it's gone from being, what, a multiple of 3 years to the average income to, what, now 10 or something? Nine? And that's where it goes. When people are having to pay 50% of their income just in securing accommodation, and then you've got power prices that are rising by 700% because, again, our friends at the WEF think we should be using less energy. it's tempting to see things as simple, but they rarely are. And they go against that government imperative that governments love anything that makes people demand less freedom and more government. So governments aren't big on funding anything that provides self-reliance or self-sufficiency. They are far, far keener on dependence. And you heard that as a major talking point from Labor MPs. It sort of died off a bit, but I noticed it went through a little cloud of it. The government services that people depend on. It's like,
Part of the problem. Yeah, that is part of the self-agency. Self-agency has been eroded from people for years, and it got literally forced off you during the COVID crisis. You know, you were locked up at home and told what to do. Do you feel that we're all living in a political case of Stockholm syndrome?
Well, yes.
We're sitting around waiting for our...
is through compassion, where we, you know, it's not like, you lazy bums, you know, you be independent. It's like, hey, you feel good. You feel good when you go out to work and then you come home and you've got money that you've earned and you buy food for your family and you're making good choices and they start to add up and people start to depend on you and look to you for inspiration. That's a nice place to be. You know, you can really start to see how artificial the happiness you get from drinking or taking drugs is, or, you know, the sense of control you might get from giving yourself a hit of nicotine when you're suffering withdrawals. You can have something real.
Speaking about stuff getting real, let's have a little cast our eyes now away, overseas. The United Kingdom, I mean, it's interesting, you know, one man's protest is another man's riot. They've had months and months and months of protests since October. Some have been violent and some have been very violent and some have been large and peaceful and lots of disruption. There's just been sort of talk about gentle, peaceful protests. Then you have a trigger point. Think BLM, you know, fiery but mostly peaceful protests, all kicked off by a single trigger point. You've now had a trigger point where a young Welsh-born boy, and he is Welsh, he's Welsh. He happens to have Rwandan parents, but this kid was Welsh. And he's autistic. And I hate to think what that kid has been watching. And he went off and executed the most monstrous act, killed these young kids. And it has now sparked protests. And it's that pendulum of the people, pendulum people, as I used to call them, the swingers in the middle, the wobbly middle, those pendulum people all of a sudden have started waking up because protesting is obviously something that the left do, but rioting, according to the media, is something that the far right do. And according to Keir Starmer, far right theory.
One of the themes that I thought about a lot this week was the fawning response. And you see it a lot. John Key, classic fawning response at a National Party conference. You know, saying, well, you know, we don't want to antagonize Maori too much. So, you know, and if we enshrine, you know, what the principles of the treaty, I mean, they would have changed. So it's better to just go along with, which Michael Laws had a really good comment about John Key and how that kind of wishy-washiness characterized his 9 years in power, inability to actually deal with things and how poll-driven he was. And that fawning response you can also see all through the media response. No one wants to criticize Islam because they kill people. That's why we don't see, and it's been said by many people, that's why the black mass that opened the Olympic Games wasn't parodying Islam.
Well, as Rachel said, Paris would still be burning if it did.
Yeah, it would. And I've said before, Maori have taken a few leaves from the Islamic playbook in terms of sacred anger, where if you say anything or take away any progress they perceive they've made, you the mooing. It's that Roger Kipling poem, When the Saxon Begins to Hate, you know, that if we're seeing this breaking out now among British people, that's a real bad thing. It's bad on the level of, you know, this is going to not just slow down. This has already got a lot of momentum. And, you know, you're dealing with people who cheerfully got bombed for years. they might be in some ways unrecognizable, but there's something about the British people that's been observed for millennia. They're bloody-minded, and once they get a bee in their bonnet, I mean, I've seen pictures of Catholics and Protestants marching together in Ireland. You know, this is potentially not going to end well. And you've got to, as I always say, zoom out a little bit. It's not the Muslims that you find at the root of this. It's the people who've pumped these places full of incompatible immigrants and then allowed them to form ghettos. And it's been done cynically. Tony Blair really kicked it off deliberately. Why? It's because governments love anything that makes people demand less freedom and more government, and incompatible immigrants meet that test.
I mean, it's not helped by Keir Starmer calling them far-right thugs. That has not gone down well at all. And no. I saw a sign, because that's the other side too, because often with these protests, you know, a lot of these protests are being really peaceful. A lot of them are trying to rekindle their nationality. And this is the interesting thing with the Brits, right, with the English especially, is it's the one Indigenous race that's not allowed to celebrate their Indigenousness. You know, so you're not allowed to do that. They do it in their own country, and they're told that they're being racist and Islamophobic and all the rest of it.
Well, Leo Malloy said something stupid like that on Twitter, you know, this week. Oh, you know, country that's gone and colonized people for 400 years are getting colonized now and they don't like it. Well, you know, good job, essentially. But, you know, these people who are coming to England aren't offering the civil service or railways as a consolation prize for the colonization. I have family who are immigrants to the UK and have worked in the NHS and, you know, have done nothing but good in that country. But there are also rape gangs, so.
Things are definitely kicking off there. And it's certainly, I mean, Keir Starmer hasn't had a chance to get his boots under the desk at number 10. So I do fear that things are only going to escalate in the United Kingdom. So far, the response, I mean, you've got to crack down. There are going to be absolute idiots and thugs in that group. Of course there is.
Yeah.
But how do you then figure out those who are thugs and those, you know, the far right from the fed up, as I saw, because there's plenty of fed up. Plenty of fed up, and they are just, they've had enough. They've had enough of being told what to do. They've had enough of the gaslighting. They're seeing it now. They're sick of the gaslighting. And I think they kind of thought, oh, look, I'm aware of it, but if I just need to carry on and keep doing what I'm doing. But they can't do that anymore. You know, they're finding that silence has been compliance. Yeah. And so in that silence, they've been complicit. And this is how revolutions start.
Yeah, and this is how extreme crackdowns are justified as well, is worth remembering. They may think that they're starting a revolution, but they could be giving Jacinda Ardern and Chris Hipkins friends at the WEF and, you know, the neo-feudalists an excuse just to tighten the screws a bit, to crack down on freedom. You know, this could be the reason to introduce that digital currency with the social credit function. And AI is already tracking where everyone is via their phones already. Yeah, it's potentially very bad. If you combine that with the way the European Union is suppressing that democratic voice of so many Europeans, say, hey, we've had enough of this.
Well, there's been protests right across Europe as well. You know, the Austria, Germany, where else have I seen it? It's same sort of thing, you know, just wanting to protect their own nationalism and not in a nasty way, just saying this is who we are. We want to be able to protect that. And one of the countries that have been able to do it most effectively, of course, is the Hungarians. And they've been stoutly criticized. And the Poles, But they've been stoutly criticized for that for years.
Yeah. I mean, I've often said my experiences with Muslims are very similar to my experience with gang members. Overwhelmingly, they've been pretty positive and interesting, with a couple of episodes of absolute terror. I got caught in just getting off a bus once, and ahead of me there happened to be a lady going to a fancy dress party dressed as a sort of maybe she was a stripper, I don't know. She was in little PVC hot pants. And I'd sort of talked to her briefly before getting off the bus, and we went into a very rapey crowd of Middle Eastern men, and they just, you know, started very aggressively speaking to this woman. And one of them said to me, oh, is this your girlfriend? And stupidly, I said, yeah, she is. And they, you know, moved to grab both of us, and the woman started saying, you know, swearing at them to F off. A few of them started coming to presumably attack me, and she ran off. And one of them, I always remember, said, "She's getting away." And then I ran off in the other direction, and they were a bit dumbfounded because they thought we were together. They didn't realize that I'd only sort of met her 2 minutes ago. But it was a very, very uncomfortable feeling. And that's happening right through Europe, only worse, right through Britain, only worse. And if, you know, they are us, if that lack of examination of what it says on the box happens, and any questioning of it is characterized as racist or Islamophobic, that's the fawning response again.
And we can't apply the New Zealand lens of this to what's happening in Europe, because in the New Zealand lens, we have very, very tight immigration, and those who have immigrated to New Zealand have become part of the fabric of New Zealand and have integrated and had their families and have set up communities and done all of those things that you would expect of somebody coming to live in your country, you know, coming to your home and wanting to be part of it. And we have this wonderful tapestry of people here. It is not the case in Europe.
Well, it's because, you know, there is a pretty predictable progression. You know, we're still at the 2 or 3%. You have your religion, I have mine. You know, it's once you get to 15% or 16%, which France is at, and you've got the ghettos, and then they start eliminating non-believers.
Oh, try 30, 40 and 50% in the likes of Liverpool, Manchester. And
that you're over Red Rover at that point.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Now, what else have you got to cover before we go to feedback?
There are a couple of good columns in the paper. Matthew Hooton's doing some really good work. You know, where you've got Liam Dann, you know, who only really has one tune, and it's monetary theory's working. Matthew Hooton actually does run the numbers, and he often talks about how in 2006 Treasury projected annual surpluses to 2030, including the super fund. It picked net government savings of 12% of GDP by 2017, approaching 16% by 2024. Treasury didn't know Bill English would run cash deficits for 8 years, or that Grant Robertson would double their damage in just 4. He lays it out in a way that is quite unique in the mainstream media at the moment. His premise of his column was, started with, "Okay, smartass, a national loyalist said, what would you do?" So he spells out what he'd do, and it's a pretty strong bit of medicine. He's saying that spending cuts aren't going to cut it alone. We really need to boost productivity. Only radical productivity gains and new sources of revenue will change the fiscal track. Meanwhile, we face multiple infrastructure, environmental and social crises. He's saying, how would I answer the national loyalists' challenge? First is accepting the key English government wasn't the unmitigated success party activists think. Being just half as bad as Ardern and Robertson is nothing to boast about. So he sort of outlines what they did that, you know, went unexamined possibly. Talks about government picking winners and rewarding donors generally involves handing taxpayers money and granting indulgences to self-identified losers. He suggests abolishing company tax, and I'd fully reopen the economy to foreign investment. Very low financial transactions tax could be considered, perhaps 0.5%. Ordinary consumers already pay 5 times that to use PayWave. He's basically saying we're going to need to make some radical tax change. And he's saying there's little doubt the next Labor government will introduce a capital gains tax or David Parker's more radical wealth tax. Choose your poison. You'll be paying one within a decade. A capital gains tax would be better. Better still would be National designing it based on sound economics rather than Labor motivated by class war. Pretty interesting and bold ideas, which is what the media should host. Richard Preble also suggests, you know, he wrote a column on Wednesday last week, government hopeless at business, so just focus on cutting red tape. Yeah, again, his tune of, look, everything government does in terms of running business sucks. He cites his time as a director of Main Freight as an example of how businesses that government would never pick could be multinational successes and generate huge revenue for New Zealand. It is likely there are more Bruce Plesteds, Peter Becks, and Matt and Nick Mowbrays with world-winning ideas that are being stifled by red tape and planning laws. They will be in sectors that no one in government imagines New Zealand can be competitive. Again, that the beige national party at the moment, which is in some ways a continuation of John Key, although we've seen with, you know, with Luxon and the lovely Erica Stanford grabbing education, I guess really confronting how unacceptable the poor performance that we've seen for decades is and how we're not going to get better without improving that.
I mean, look, for me, National is not a blue party anymore. It's a purple party. It has been a purple party for quite a long time.
Yeah, probably stirring some green there as well. It sort of goes brown, doesn't it?
You know, you look at Hooton's solution. Oh, gosh, part of me just wonders, how different would things look if you had a national leader who went all melee on the public service and actually cut out just the absolute bloat that was there? I mean, one of the articles on the weekend's paper, I think the Sunday Star Times, government spending thousands on white privilege workshops. Why? Why?
Yeah.
I mean, take everything back to absolute basic principles, because all this puffery, why?
Yeah. At a moment, and when I was returned to study for one paper at Waikato University, where I said, do you think it's white privilege? And everyone leaned forward with expectant, happy grins that it was going to be a white man flagellating himself about his white privilege. I said, do you think it's white privilege that if there's something rotten in our culture, we can take it out and say, well, this isn't working for us. Maybe it's unfair. Whereas we patronise Māori by telling them that everything bad that happens to them is someone else's fault and their culture is absolutely perfect. So we don't allow them agency to change. And there was just such an awkward silence, as you might expect. You know, in some ways that is white privilege. We've just had the shit kicked out of us in terms of being forced to confront our shadows and the things that we did that were maybe, that were objectively ugly.
Mm. It also, again, this comes back to all of these protests and all of these things that are there, right? As you said, there's an ugliness there, but also you've had a group of people that have pushed things, that swung things too far in one direction. Those who have been sitting there thinking, oh, this is someone else's problem, it's going to go away, have now realised that it's not going away.
Well, the other thing that you could think about is, you know, how you hear a lot about white supremacy and the implication is that it's a race-based thing. Something that occurred to me the other day was, you know, maybe it's because we were at a point culturally where we had a platform where we really could become more enlightened as a species based on the Western model of Western democracy. And sure, there were all sorts of ugly things to get it there, but it was a platform, and it's certainly a platform that people from around the world have flocked to. And that sort of pinching it off and, oh, no, 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 you know, what you need is more tribalism. No, what you need is to get back to more animism. No, you need to get back to more tribal violence. Is it just a way to block human progress by characterizing it as essentially a Nazi kind of conceit?
Right, we've got some feedback. Firstly, so if a victim wants healing without legal redress against the perpetrator, that leaves a person with this compulsion to abuse free to continue. That was in reference to Satechi Collins and the work that she does with ECPAT New Zealand. A message from Marie. While I enjoy much of your program and material, I do become annoyed at your constant reference to this country as Aotearoa New Zealand. Following on from the woke MSM, your parroting of this divisive narrative is inappropriate, in my opinion. Please refrain, Alan. Alan?
I don't
know. Other than reading out your email, I've never once said Aotearoa New Zealand in an interview, because I just choose not to. I always say New Zealand.
You're supposed to refer to the country as Aotearoa for a while.
But I think you'll find that my guest, Teachy, did refer to it as that several times in an interview with her. So it was her, not me. But I do appreciate that sometimes that can be triggering for people. All I can say, Alan, is I know that it probably annoys you, but sometimes you just need to paddle past the rapids and keep moving forward. Here we go. This is one for you, Marty. I love Marty's perspective. Go Trumps. Cheers, Steve from Lower Hutt.
Oh, cheers, Steve.
Another one for us here at Media Matters. Having spent 3 months with my partner in Auckland Hospital, I can give them a few suggestions. Put the orderlies and cleaners in charge. They are continually on the job and actually working and knowing more about the process of running a hospital than the doctors. Set a maximum size for hospitals, build more in the provinces, and downsize the large, inoperable cancers that our hospitals have become.
Mm. Well, Stephen Joyce referred to that in a column, I think it was last week, and we didn't come to this point of it, but he said, you know, that had the procurement that was hospital-based, and so surprise, surprise, the emphasis tended to be on hospital-based care rather than primary care. Mm-hmm. And he was suggesting that procurement should be rather more like ACC and just buy services. And as someone who is involved in a private medical clinic, I can say, yeah, we'd be a lot more efficient at it.
Well, on that theme, the next piece of feedback said that Dr. Shane Retty owns 0.24% of Kensington Private Surgery in Whangarei. The surgery makes a fortune from working with Whangarei Hospital, can't do due to waiting lists. Many of Kensington's shareholders and surgeons are also employed at the hospital and refer work from the hospital to Kensington. Right. This is an area that both you and I know quite a lot about.
Yeah.
Firstly, 0.24% of a private surgical centre is nothing. So I wouldn't be getting too hung up on the numbers. Secondly, there is an assumption that if you work for the public hospital, if you're a doctor working in the public hospital, the assumption by most people is that their contracts are full-time contracts. In many cases, particularly in consultants, they are not. Full-time is considered a 0.8 in the public sector. Most of them sit at 0.5, 0.4, sometimes even 0.3, depending on where you are, especially in regional areas. So what that then means is those consultants often will need to find or supplement work elsewhere. So they will go to work for a private facility. The difference between private facilities and public facilities was outlined when Dr. Retty, in his piece last week, talked about the layers between patients and the board and managements within hospital and how many layers you need to get to go from referral through to surgery, and it's extensive. In the private setting, not so much. So they're able to turn over and get more surgeries done and an allotted space of time than what they can in the public setting. What has been happening now in New Zealand for quite some time, easily 15 years, if not more, is an overflow of surgery, particularly non-urgent and elective surgeries, are then subcontracted by the government into those private facilities in order to get the wait lists down. And traditionally, you would see a whole heap of that done either just before the budgetary period ran out or just before an election. Those are the two times that would happen. And that has been the norm. And in fact, in some areas now, elective surgery is not done at the public hospital at all. It's all done in private facilities. And they can do it quicker and faster. And just to give you, again, another example is publicly cataract operations. It would be often in a session, they would do 4 to 6 at best in a public setting of a standard cataract operation. And a lot of the public cataracts weren't standard because you had to be the worst of the worst to actually get past the point system in order to get surgery in the first place. So they often were quite difficult surgeries. So in a session, you would maybe get 4 or 5 if they were really tough cases. In the private setting, they could, in some cases, double that because of the efficiencies of throughput and productivity that they're able to place in a smaller, more streamlined system than what they are in the public system. So therefore, it's a better bang for buck to actually subcontract that out into the private sector, which I know is a really long-winded explanation. I could go on, but do you want to add to that, Marty? Because it is something that I think people don't necessarily understand, that without the private surgical offering in this country, our situation would be vastly worse shape.
Yeah, there's the conceit that people working in the public sector sometimes have that they're offering a free service. it's a very expensive service, and there's real suffering behind long waiting lists. And if you can get them cleared more cheaply and more efficiently, that's why we should do it, because we don't have any more capacity to absorb costs that have their roots in some ideological conceit.
Yeah, agreed. The next one is from Julie. She actually says Shane Reti owns 4% of the Kensington private clinic. The numbers are relevant. I mean, if he's invested in a private clinic, so what, he's invested in a private clinic?
I'd rather that he had the experience getting one of those organisations running efficiently as Minister of Health than I'm concerned that he still owns a part of it.
Yeah, to me, it's quite irrelevant. For you, with the Fourth Estate, from Lynn, thanks, team, for another brilliant panel. Rachel, your AI comment was a LOL moment. Yeah, that Fourth Estate really was really very good, Marty.
Oh.
Political panel, but let's do some Marty feedback. For the political panel, List MPs should be automatically expelled from Parliament if they leave their party, as the sole reason for their presence is proportionality. If an electorate MP leaves their party, List MPs should be rejuggled to re-establish proportionality. This is the heart of MMP. That's from David. What Air New Zealand's backing out of is the 2030 emission reductions target, with former climate change minister James Shaw as their state sustainability advisor. Eating dead rats comes to mind. Oh, is that where James Shaw ended up?
Yeah, it's just not practical.
No, that would have been a hairy bollock for him to suck. Oh dear. Okay, we used to enjoy almost daily what used to be the Department of Conservation Reserve at 5 Mile Bay Taupo until it became Māori land. Access was then denied to the public in general, despite previous assurances that this would not happen. What is public land, etc., should always remain public land for all New Zealanders to enjoy. That's from the text machine.
That is it's another thing that you think about and just sigh deeply, and you just think, oh man, this isn't going to end well. Just to give another RCR show a plug, I've been listening to Greenwashed a bit more, which is absolutely excellent. The only reason I don't listen to it more is I don't have the time I need, really. But Muriel Newman, any time I see Muriel Newman, I always try and catch it, because she's so just focused and just so good. And her closing statement on Greenwashed was fantastic, about how people need to stand up, and because otherwise it's their children who are going to suffer. The wailing from Te Pāti Māori now is largely of their own doing. I think a lot of New Zealanders are just looking at them and looking at how they've got that impulse toward tyranny and thinking, man, those guys have already got too much power.
Speaking of Te Pāti Māori and another show, did you hear Paul interview Takuta Ferris last week?
No, I didn't. I'll catch it.
I was scrolling through the replays when I was doing my doggy walk and of the things I like to listen to, and hello, I saw that there from Friday, and I thought, I missed that. Woo. Firstly, ups for Takuta coming on RCR. So thank you. And it was good. It was interesting. It's nice to see some voices from the other side of the political fence coming on RCR, and that I think is really important. And I know some people find that a bit crunchy, but it's good. We want this. Yeah. This is great.
It's just like the whole thing with the preponderance of left-wing people in the media, where there's 80% people who are those, you know, more government, less freedom types. I don't want 80% less government, more freedom. I'd like it to be 50-50.
Mm.
And it's like that with Māori issues. You know, I'm interested to hear what they've got to say, but they can't then stop anyone answering back or characterise any objection to what they're saying as racist.
Yeah, it is good. And so do definitely check it out. And the other interview I listened to in my little bundle of out for walkies was, other than you and the Fourth Estate, and that was Trotter back on the crunch, which was great. That was fantastic. It was good to have Chris back, and it was, and as always, Cam's political interviews are just brilliant. And I know
best
Simon
political journalism in New Zealand with zero government funding, probably not a coincidence.
So this is the problem. I don't know whether you find this, Marty, and whether you find this, listeners, Just finding the time to consume all this content. I know I struggle week in, week out because there is just so much great stuff happening. And remember, if you've got anything you would like to share with us, for Marty or I, inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email and 2057 is the text number. All right. Thank you, Marty, for your time again this week. And we'll do it all again next week. Don't disappear. Of course, I will be back very shortly to catch you up on what's going on. And of course, Natalie Cutler-Welsh will be along very, very soon after 1 o'clock. All right, Marty, thank you.
Have a great week. Thanks very much.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.